All right, so good evening. So tonight we begin our year-long exploration into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So Tuari and I will both be sharing that and exploring that over this next year. So one of the key things to understand with these teachings is that they're very much the core of the Buddha's teachings. You know, the Four Noble Truths is one of the key things to understand in this tradition. It's also important to understand that the teachings aren't like in isolation. Even though we'll go through one at a time, month by month, they're very much integrated. So try to hold that in your mind as we go through this year, that one truth affects the other, informs the other, and vice versa. We'll separate them out piece by piece, but remember they're part of a whole. They really enhance each other, support each other, and inform each other. We don't want to lose sight of the whole and the forest for the trees. So what are these Four Noble Truths? This is often said as being the first talk the Buddha gave after his awakening, after his time under the Bodhi tree and had his deep realization. He sought out the monks or the ascetics that he was practicing with and gave them this first talk about the Four Noble Truths. This is often thought of in this tradition and the broader traditions as turning the wheel of the Dharma, starting this whole process of the Dharma unfolding. So these four truths, the truth of dukkha, the origination of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. So dukkha is what we'll focus on for this month. So what is this word dukkha? What does that mean? Because you can see it's really central to this whole Four Noble Truths. It's in the first one that there is dukkha, there's a cause or origination of that dukkha, there's a sensation of that dukkha, and there's a path to the freedom, the release of that dukkha. Dukkha is an interesting word because there's not one single English word that we can use to really capture its meaning. It has a lot of nuance, it has a lot of broad understandings of this, different levels and different meanings of this word. And words have a certain power and association with us, you know, because of our history, our conditioning. One word means one thing to one person and another one to someone else. So one common translation of dukkha is the word suffering, is suffering. So this is somewhat accurate. It's an ordinary uses of that word in Pali, but also is a bit problematic. When you think of the word suffering, what comes to mind? Is you just reflect on that word. You know, if you're like my mind, you think of some of the very difficult, some of the most painful experiences, you know, physical, mental, emotional pain and suffering. And that is this, seems to represent this word suffering. So dukkha certainly includes this, but also there's a lot more to this word that we'll explore tonight. Some of the essential aspects, try to flesh those out. As an aside, to kind of talk about the importance of translations, I'm going to quote Sharon Salzberg in her book, Loving Kindness. So she was teaching in Russia, I think probably before the fall of the Soviet Union, and teaching about compassion, right? So compassion. And as she was teaching, the first time I was teaching meditation in the Soviet Union, I talked a lot about compassion. As the words are being translated into Russian, I kept getting the funny feeling that I was not conveying my meaning clearly. You know, and when she's talked here in person, she's talked about the word, people just seem to be getting more and more kind of depressed and heavy and kind of, you know, furrowed brows. So I finally asked the interpreter, when I say compassion, what do you say? He answered, oh, I describe a state of being terribly overcome by someone's sorrow, like having a stake through your heart. and having the burden of someone's pain, somebody's pain, burdening you as well. I just sat there thinking, oh no. Have you ever met, you know, I've sat with Sharon and know Sharon, that's very much her. You know, just that, the humor of that, but also just that the words are being translated very differently. The word compassion in this case. So too with suffering has a stern connotation. That's why I actually like to use the Pali of dukkha, because it makes our minds kind of pause for a second. Our associations don't just rush in to fill in the blank. There's like, okay, let me listen to this. Let me see what dukkha really is. What is it in my experience? So trying to find a more accurate understanding of dukkha, and also to see what makes it noble. These are the four noble truths, not the four, you know, kind of nice truths or the kind of unfortunate truths. They're the noble truths. And why is it at the core of the Buddhist teaching? We get a sense, actually, that any single word of English doesn't hold this word of dukkha very adequately. The Buddha, in one of the suttas, describes dukkha this way. Now this, bhikkhus, you know, practitioners, is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. So this is a common, you know, phrase or description that's repeated many times in the sutta, and it brings a certain understanding of the word dukkha. I kind of get a sense that dukkha isn't so good. It's kind of a downer. It's not very pleasant. So it made me think suffering is an okay translation. Yet if we just stay at this level, at just this one description of dukkha, it's not enough. It's not complete. In another sutta, the Buddha is listing the different types of happiness that arise. The happiness of a family life and the happiness of being a recluse, happiness of sense pleasures and happiness of renunciation, happiness of attachment and the happiness of detachment, physical happiness and mental happiness, etc. And all these are also dukkha. He also calls all these are dukkha. Right? So how can we hold, you know, the pain and suffering, but also happiness? How can they both be dukkha? How does that work? So it's beyond what we normally would think of as suffering, states of suffering. Even further, some of the very esoteric and sublime states that we can encounter as meditators, some of the trance states or absorption states, where just the mind is so still and there's really no sense of the hindrances arising in those experiences, in those states. Those too are dukkha, specifically stated so by the Buddha. See, it's important to remember that the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, he was spent about 6 years going through India trying to find the most skilled teachers he could to help him solve this problem of why does suffering arise? And what's the end of that suffering? What's the arising of dukkha and the releasing of dukkha? And so he studied with two particular masters of concentration and learned their system so well, he was invited to teach with them as equals. But still the Buddha felt this wasn't enough, because those states of mind, no matter how pleasant, how sublime, were still dukkha. They still would not have a quality of unsatisfactoriness to them. In other parts of the Pali Canon and the collected works of this tradition, they talk about these different heavenly realms. These realms where a desire, as soon as you thought the desire would be met, think of like instant Amazon Prime. All right, you just, okay, click it and then suddenly it appears. All right, so these states, I mean, that's, you know, close for some of us, our states of life have that quality of instant gratification. We're used to such quick, we go on the internet and listen to a movie or a something very quickly without having to wait. So these heavenly realms are these, you know, very pleasant places to be. And these too are dukkha. These too are dukkha. Another realm, another sutta, the Buddha talks about these heavenly realms and how long they last. There's different categories. Some last for a certain number of eons. And he kept adding more and more eons. So beyond our conception of time, you know, beyond the sense of time, because we often think of dukkha as something that maybe is more, it's pleasant, but it will end. But if it goes many times beyond the human lifespan, even those are dukkha. So again, the Buddha kept circling around defining what is beyond dukkha, beyond this quality of dukkha. Dukkha is often translated as this quality of unsatisfactoriness, a sense of things not quite being perfect, you know, a little bit off. Joseph Goldstein tells a story about, or a translation of the word dukkha, being like a wheel that doesn't quite sit right, so it kind of wobbles a bit. And one time he was in India on a cart that the wheel wasn't sitting very right, and it was very bumpy as he went through that, kind of that expression of dukkha. So considering your life, you know, with all its comforts, with all its pleasures, with all its pain, with all its sorrow, all this is dukkha. So what does this word dukkha really represent? And there's really two common factors that we can use to get a strong handle on this word dukkha. The first is whatever is impermanent is dukkha. So whatever is impermanent is dukkha. Whatever is subject to change, that is not last everlasting, has a quality of dukkha to it. So the Buddha said this again and again. You know, probably with people coming up and saying, you know, I had this great experience in meditation. You know, I think I've really got it. And he says that too is dukkha. In our own modern history, Ajahn Chah would often respond when a teacher, a student would come up and describe these beautiful states and attainments in meditation. And he would say, something else to let go of, something else to release. So with this word dukkha, starting to orient to anything that's not, that's in process of change, that's not fixed as being dukkha, no matter what the time frame might be. For physical, imagining this building here, it feels very substantial, very solid, but enough of a time frame, it will eventually decay, eventually collapse. Our homes, our cities, everything's in a process of change. It may be a very slow change, but it is slowly deteriorating. And at the same time, things are arising too. You can see the construction. So dukkha is not just about things falling apart, but also the arising of things. It's this constant process of flux. So this week, I'm encouraging us to practice, just as we drive our cars or walk on the street, to feel that this thing that seems so solid is in dukkha. It's not everlasting. It's impermanent. Our possessions, the things we cherish. There was a Zen teacher who, whenever he would receive some gift, he would imagine it already broken. You get a beautiful teacup and imagine it already shattered. And then there's a different way of relating to that. There's a preciousness of meeting that contact, but also realizing that it's not something you can hold on to. What about our bodies? There's a sense of impermanence, that our bodies change, they get older. If you doubt me, just look at a photo album. See how things are changing, that this hand is dukkha. So it's the sense of contemplating, seeing something that you take as being fixed, that you assume as being lasting, and just letting that in, letting your mind accommodate to the fact that things are in flux, that things are changing. It's not about becoming in a state of despair or depression, but just noticing that things are always in process. always in change. And with the Dharma, part of what we learn is to see through that illusion of permanence, to see that things are actually in flux. And then we learn to align ourselves with that truth, with that characteristic, then there's an ease that comes with that. That Zen master, when his cup would shatter, when it would drop, okay, I already have seen it fall apart. Dukkha, including our thoughts, our emotions. Has anyone found a thought that can just never changes? It just stays constant? The mind is constantly thinking. Emotions are constantly arising and passing away. So it's like a shift of orientation, because so often we focus on the state of mind itself, on the emotion itself. But shift to this quality of it being impermanent, being in flux, to the quality of it being, the dukkha-ness of it, if you will. Even the ones that are very convincing, very gripping, that this too is dukkha. All our experiences, you know, both good and bad, holding that this is impermanent. I've shared this story about my grandfather when he was dying in hospice, and he was a Christian, and he talked about this phrase from the Bible, that this too shall pass, and how he felt that was one of the most significant phrases in the Bible, that this too shall pass. You know, it's a different way of expressing this quality of dukkha. So this sense of impermanence, this sense of things are always in flux, that we can't find something that's completely stationary. Even if we go into a very long time frame, this is a core quality of dukkha, core expression of dukkha. And a second factor of dukkha is that anything that's conditioned, anything that's based on circumstances coming together, is also in flux, is also a quality of dukkha. Especially anything that's conditioned as a sense of me, a sense of self, a sense of who we are. So this is in some ways more of a subtle quality, because the very eyes that we look out have that assumption of that I'm looking out already. I'm already looking out and seeing you. So it's already established, like the view is already fixed before we start to even see it. Well, with impermanence, we can come from that view and look at things which are flux and changing and say, oh yeah, I can see the seasons change. I can see that my body is different than it was 10 years ago. You know, there's a way we can still have our normal positioning. But to step back to actually see this sense of me requires sincerity. It requires a sense of willingness to question that very assumption, that very preconception that we live with. That sense of I am solid. I am static. It's an interesting question sometimes to ask yourself when you feel, I am feeling this, I am thinking this. You say, okay, where is that I? Where exactly is that I? And look inside and see where that's located. Is it something solid that you can really contact? A locus that you can say, okay, this is really where that is? Or is it something much more changing, more of a contraction perhaps energetically, or a slight a perspective? And as we look, we can't find that locus. Okay. And so when we have this deeper seeing of that self, then dukkha is not arising. But when we come from that state of self, then that dukkha is present. Anything we take as being I, being me, being mine, this is who I am, is inherently dukkha. It's inherently part of change. And including everything that flows from that assumption. Right? The assumption of me is just like that. That's the baseline. That's like the rules of the game have been established. And then there's, I'm feeling this. I have to say this. I'm afraid of that. I love this and that. That's the deep perspective that holds that. This is what I know is right. This is what I know is wrong. The whole sense of opinionation flows from that base assumption of I. What I want, what I don't want. And so much of our practice is learning to break the enchantment of that. Enchantment of that wanting, that sense of not wanting, that projection outward and inward. And it's very tricky because if we focus on that, we try to figure out how can I make this better? How can I work with this? But never questioning that much deeper perspective of self that's still maintained. And so we find ourselves fixing one part of our lives to find another part falling apart. That sounds a lot like dukkha. So this is all dukkha, this quality of I'm feeling, the sense of deep perspective. And this is equally outward too, the outward projection of self, the sense of putting our energy into, okay, this is a particular person, someone I might love, someone I might hate. There's still that sense of formation that goes outward. This is still a quality of dukkha. You're this way, you're that way. You know, thinking about someone that is maybe charged in your experience. You know, maybe a random political figure with orangish hair or something like that. If someone comes to mind, so when you think of that person or someone else, there's an idea that just rises up with that. Okay, I know who that person is. I have that all that emotion. The room's kind of squirrely a little bit from that, because that just loads right up. That sense of, that's the projection outward. That's inherently dukkha. If we get caught in that projection and what we believe is true with that, we miss the fact that dukkha is actually arising in that moment. Okay, so this practice is really about learning to question the validity of that dukkha, to not place our hopes, not to place our trust in dukkha. The things that are impermanent, that are empty, not be mistaken about what really is its true nature. And as we project outward on a particular individual, there's also this sense of me who's arising with that. They both arise. To project outward, I have to arise up first, too. So these almost double quality of dukkha that's arising. So you start to get a sense how multiple layers of interacting dukkha arise. See, dukkha, it's an interesting quality because in the suttas it sounds like it's almost like a statement that this is dukkha. And as we look at the whole Four Noble Truths, we see that dukkha is actually more of something that we do to experience. We do something to experience to create this quality of suffering, of impermanence. There's an innate quality to it, but when we try to fix it as being solid, that's when we suffer. And when we take that sandcastle and try to keep it so it never changes, and when it does change, we experience suffering. We experience the pain of dukkha. When we take a sense of me, that sense of identity, I know there's many people, you know, in the room and listening, who maybe you've retired, and reflect about how that transition was from working until not working. That loss of identity, that loss of identification. If you have a child that's grown up and left the home, how there's that loss of being a parent. There's a sense of identity, a sense of flowing into that, and then that identity has to die, to change. Okay? Because we hold that, we kind of grip that, that creates this dukkha. This is what the second noble truth that Tueri will explore next month. So it's hard to kind of separate just one truth from all the others because they really inform each other. So the sense of identification and the sense of creating a sense of self is a key part of what where dukkha arises. Going back to that piece, now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. That section there, you may recognize as a piece of dependent origination. So dependent origination is this very, very well thought out, very accurate description of how we create a sense of self. Right? So we create a sense of me, that's the birth. Okay, when birth arises, there's going to be aging, it follows. You rise up, then aging will happen. And after aging, there's death. And after death, there's this, the pain, the lamentation, the sorrow. All this is dukkha. So the Buddha is saying here that that selfing, the act of selfing, of taking form, is in itself dukkha. So don't get thrown off by the sense of birth and aging and death. It certainly applies in the whole lifespan of a human being. But it also applies each moment, multiple times in each day. And during this course of this talk, there's a word that may have been spoken that triggered a certain reaction. That's a taking birth. That's a taking form in that. There's a way you're relating to that. And then there's a lifespan, it fades away. If it was a pleasant birth, then you suffer when it passes away. If it was unpleasant, you kind of feel, oh, I'm glad that's over. The last part, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. The five clinging aggregates are another way of describing how the sense of self forms. Right? So these two qualities of impermanence and selfing are a key component of what makes dukkha. So you can see it's much more nuanced than just the word suffering, or a sense of unsatisfactoriness. You know, unsatisfactoriness, I think, is a little bit better of a word, but it doesn't convey just the deep mechanism of dukkha. The dukkha isn't like this kind of abstract thing. It's something that we're living with every moment. Every day, dukkha is always present, always arising. And just the question is, how do we relate to that? How do we work with that? So working with these two qualities of impermanence and non-self gives us perhaps a better handle on what dukkha really is and how it shows up in our lives. So we start to see it in all our experience. And to start to see where dukkha isn't. Where's the absence of dukkha? So remember, this isn't just a one noble truth tradition. It's four noble truths. There's dukkha, there's origination of dukkha, and there's a cessation of dukkha. And there's the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. The second noble truth, just to say a few words about that, it's really this process of taking what is inherently impermanent and trying to make it permanent. What's inherently impermanent, trying to fix it, to make it solid. So it's really going against the flow of nature. Taking what's inherently empty of self and creating a sense of self with that, this creates dukkha. It's this relationship which almost activates dukkha. It's like this, it's a mental, psychological, emotional, spiritual, energetic relationship to life that arises. And if we relate to it a certain way, as a second noble truth explores, then dukkha arises too. If you don't activate it, dukkha won't arise. So it's important to recognize dukkha, but it's equally important to recognize the absence of dukkha. The absence of dukkha. So what is not dukkha? So if there's an origination of dukkha, then that means there must be a cessation of dukkha. The second and third noble truths. So what is not dukkha? What is not impermanent? What is not self? This takes us, if we look at impermanence as this way, we can kind of almost intellectually still look and see impermanence, see the truth, accept that. Going to a sense of understanding self requires a much deeper release, a deeper sense of stepping back and being willing not to keep engaging that perspective, that assumption. Even a deeper step is to see what is beyond both of those. What is beyond impermanence? What is beyond self? And this requires, it's almost like a Zen koan, that we have to be willing to release our normal way of seeing life. You know, it's not like an intellectual exercise, it's a very deep releasing, a deep shifting. The other thing, though, is that what's beyond dukkha is always present. It's always here. We often lose our relationship to it. We get caught, we get fixated on things, we get lost in thought. And so our access to it is what's changing. But what's beyond it is not changing. We could call it awareness, as Rodney often called that, a quality of not mindfulness, not a sense of intentionality or effort of me paying attention to this breath, to this sensation, but awareness itself is that sense of deep knowing. The knowing that's beyond self, that's not self-driven. It's something that precedes self, that's beyond, before self. So then it's not about trying to create something, to establish something. All that is inherently dukkha, right? When I try to create something, when I try to put something together, right? But to actually be quiet, to release the need to do. And then there's a subtle hint of this deep awareness, a sense of knowing that's behind all my actions, all my doing. And then I just relax into that, surrender into that, have faith that I don't have to do anything in this moment. And then what is beyond dukkha starts to reveal itself, reveal what's always been here. This is sometimes called what is unborn before taking birth. The Zen tradition has so many ways of describing this, like taking, you know, what was your face like before you were born? As we start to work with this understanding dukkha, on one hand, seeing it, seeing how things we take as permanent really aren't so permanent. Just letting the mind soften around that fact, soften around the fact that, okay, this is in flux. This is arising. It's decaying. It's not so solid. You know, just look through your environment, look through your body, look through your mind. Just see for yourself, is there something that really isn't changing? The sense of identification, the sense of this is my thought, this is your thought, this is your emotion, my emotion. Seeing how that's all quality of identification. That in itself is going to be always in flux. So start to notice that this next week. And then when the mind is still and quiet, start to notice what is beyond change, what is beyond identification. And just letting yourself rest there. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And in this moment, there's many aspects of this experience which are dukkha, are in flux, impermanent. Many aspects of identification of self. And in this same moment, there's what is beyond both of those. Beyond words, beyond needing to know, just the knowing itself. Thank you. So let's just say a few words about the practice and reflection. I touched upon this fair amount, but this is an invitation for you to take the contents of this talk home and just see where it lands, to see for yourself, as the Buddha would often invite you. See for yourself, you know, where is dukkha? Can I start to see that quality as not something that's a philosophy, but an actual way of seeing experience. So start to sensitize your attention to dukkha throughout the day. Not in a despairing way. If you start to find yourself getting depressed and kind of like, oh, okay, everything's falling apart, maybe take a break from that. Because it should bring, if you're doing it in the manner I hoped you would do it, it brings a sense of aliveness. A sense of ease, that you start to hold life a little softer, a little bit more gently. And you realize, okay, I really enjoy this experience. I enjoy this moment. And I also know this moment's not going to last forever. I may really enjoy this sense of being whatever role I'm taking or hat I'm holding right that moment. But also realizing that itself will change. And just to be more light with that, to realize, oh yeah, it will change, it will flex. And realizing that when you hold it tightly, that creates a certain rub, a certain friction. And just acknowledge and say, this is dukkha. Just maybe repeat that many times as you touch into something. Oh, this too is dukkha. This is dukkha. This structure, this is dukkha. This body is dukkha. Hold this inquiry. Is this subject to change? Is this subject to some change? Yes, then it's dukkha. Is this subject to selfing? Then this is dukkha. And when the mind is quiet, notice the absence of dukkha. to stretch. So we have some time for any questions or clarifications or comments about the talk or about anything. So many people, that's got to be at least one comment out there. Yes.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I understand asking the question, is this subject to change? But I'm a little fuzzy still on when you ask, is this subject to selfing?
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
So the comment or question is subject to change, that makes sense in the homework, but subject to selfing is a little harder to get a handle on. And again, it is a more subtle inquiry, and it may not make as much sense, but it's almost like self, it's easier to see the footprints of it, the expression of it, than the actual position at first. The position does take a lot of quietness. It takes a lot of sincerity and just willingness to either quiet or sincerity, that willingness to look really closely and see where that deep perspective is, you know, right there. So some of the footprints of it, the tracks of it, whenever you find yourself saying, you know, I'm really upset about that, or I'm really happy about that, notice that sense of I that we use, you know, that's part of our language, but it's more than language, it's also as position that we're taking. Do you get a sense of that? Or if I asked, you know, what did you do today? Or what do you do for a living? Or how was your Christmas? I say, oh yeah, it was like this. Notice how you put yourself in that position, right? But that place that you put yourself, that's no longer here in this moment, right? It's like a constant flux. You have a different set of conditions happen. There's a different you that arises. That's another way to start to get a handle of that, to notice how different senses of you are constantly popping up and falling away. The way we tend to look at it is a sense of self pops up, and then another one pops up, but we don't notice the popping up, we just notice, oh, now this is one here. It's like those cartoons when the character's kind of walking through and they don't notice they're off the cliff, but somehow something's like putting one thing under each step. So they never notice that they're actually walking in air, but there's each step is supported by something else. You know what I'm talking about? That sense of cartoon fantasy. But we have a sense of self that we just connect those dots seamlessly. But practice starts to realize, oh, there's a sense of self that's arisen, and then there's a quiet that I might come back to. And then there's something that triggers another sense of self. So it's easier to see when you're more reactive, when you're more engaged, when you have a strong opinion.
When you're watching the news.
Yeah, so here's a good practice for you. Watch the news, but when something comes up that triggers you, whether it's some sadness, some grief, some anger, whatever it might be, turn off the news. And feel that in the body. Okay, feel the anger, you know, the sense of rage and the indignation. So it's grounded in the body. But also say, okay, who is feeling this? Who is feeling this? And then you start to see that sense of self that is feeling that. And by kind of seeing those kind of real concrete ways that arises, you start to naturally see the times when it's much softer, and even the absence of that, when there's not the sense of self that's arisen. And so the practice is trying to learn, see through that illusion, how we keep connecting the dots and see that that there's not a permanent self that keeps arising. When we don't see it, dukkha is constantly arising with that. We could say that the arising of self is the same thing as the arising of dukkha. And that's one way of really looking at these Four Noble Truths. Does that help? Yeah. Yes. Okay, thank you. That's a good question. So it's how does the inner working of experiencing dukkha relate to, you know, social justice? How does it relate to the expressions of dukkha in the world, which we can actually affect and change and try to make the world a safer place, a not so unjust place? Is that, how do those two work together? The internal practice cleans up the reactivity. So then the actions in the world are much more clear and powerful and straightforward. Because when we're lost in our own reactivity, when we hear something, we just get reactive, and our whole process of dukkha's arising, we're trying to change it, you're reacting to ourselves, our archaic woundings being triggered, our unmet needs, our sense of really wanting to, you know, stand up for oppression, all those things get triggered and it becomes this, you know, big mass of stuff. From that, there's this really important impulse to act that we don't want to lose. And at the same time, if we can start to kind of really feel, okay, this is my own, this, everything's in flux, everything's in change, I am in change, then the action becomes very clear. I'm able to be much more skillful. You know, I'm able to actually reach the other side that I want to influence, and not from a sense of blame and anger, but actually connecting. And then there's a common ground that everything moves together better. You know, so that's ideally when that works well. And sometimes it takes the form of a very strong action too, of really, you know, protesting it. And but it comes from a place of clarity instead of confusion, because that's another way to say it. We move from confusion and reactivity to clarity. We are able to actually really marshal our energy. And also, we don't get so burned out. You know, I when I teach retreats, there's often people just feel so exhausted by all that's going on in the world, and so it's just there's so many things that become so overwhelming, and it's like they're so spread out, and it's beyond what they can influence. And we start to really, okay, let's stay within yourself, and you can say, what can I influence? What can I really make a difference with? You know, and as we do that, we are often surprised how that influence grows, because we're able to come from a solid place, and we have endurance. We have ability to continue to keep at it instead of being exhausted. So I think it sounds like it's incompatible. It sounds like it's a negation of the, you know, working with the wrongs of the world. But it's actually a way of really clarifying it, so you can see much more clearly the wrongs of the world. You can see the root causes of the wrongs of the world, and so then you can address those root causes much more clearly when you see those root causes in yourself. And it's a journey. It's a process. Yeah, Daniel.
Early in the evening, as we were just arriving and settling in, I heard another yogi ask you about conceptual proliferation and this sense that we bring a plot motor to experience. Could you say something about this tendency in terms of a way to catch the whiff of selfing process?
So the question is about a kind of an earlier interaction about papancha and that kind of proliferation of thought, and how there's often a kind of a seed that starts it off, and how that's a similar process to selfing, that there's a seed that starts it off. And is there a way to kind of catch the first whiff of it so we're not like, you know, 10 miles down that road before we realize, oh, I've kind of... And you look at all the damage you've caused on that path to yourself and others. Yeah, it's a very important question. And I think you kind of the trajectory of our practice, and I think many of us, as we look in the room, as we look at our, when we first started to practice and where we are now, whether it's 6 months or it's, you know, 6 years or 20 years or whatever the experience is, that our practice should be going more and more to subtlety. That at first we might just notice the really big things. Now we start to notice more subtle qualities of contraction. And so I think that a good guide is our own, our bodies. If the body is a safe axis, I know that's, I'll come back to that in a moment if it's not, because it's not always a place of refuge. But if it is, we can see, always be monitoring how the body is feeling. So not so much like, oh, it hurts here, it hurts there, but more just how is the body reacting and responding to this moment, right? Because often we happen, if you notice when you get, when someone says something that you feel upset about, there's a contraction first in the body. And then your mind goes into the meaning of it, assigns the meaning. And then from there, it's a perfect seed to make this whole proliferation of thought, proliferation of self. But if you can feel that prick, and okay, let me be still with that, notice the impulse to go into thinking, the impulse and to go into movement, into reaction, and feeling that prick, and just being still with it. So I'm still with it, I can feel, okay, there's the impulse, there's the meaning, the selfing, the shape of that selfing. And after you're with it, sometimes it's like, okay, that just passes. Other times it's like, no, I really need to say something, whether it's interpersonal or if it's something much more in society. So it's a good guide that way. But a lot of it is just a lot of repetition. Sometimes you wake up to the middle of being very reactive. It's okay, right wherever you wake up, I'm just going to be still for a moment. I'm going to pause and feel, okay, what's the body? What's the emotionality? What's the mind states? And we'll find that often our selfing, it has like kind of a pre-built, prefabricated structure that often creates, that kind of folds into. You can see this with, often very acutely with around family. You know, you can be like, oh, I feel really peaceful and calm. And I go home for the holidays, and in the first 5 minutes, my brother says something, and boom, I'm right back when I was 7. Okay, where did that come from? It's like it's preset to go that way. But that's a whole kind of a preloaded sense of self that just popped right up there. Right? So then you say, okay, let me be with that, feel that pain of that. So a lot of it is being willing to feel the discomfort instead of moving from that. That process starts to allow us to become stiller, to connect with a place beyond, before that selfing arises. And that's the process of really clarifying, purifying that, so our actions do become much clearer.
So just staying with the unpleasantness of the sensations, rather than...
That doesn't sound very fun. staying with the unpleasantness of the sensations. Well, there's an impulse, the proliferation has its own momentum, right? You know, it's like a snowball that's just getting bigger and bigger. Right? So part of it is not going down that momentum. So one pathway is just to feel the experience without moving from it, which often does involve feeling the uncomfortableness of it. But another gateway, which might be appropriate a lot of the times, is more investigation. You're just putting a question like, okay, who am I in this moment? What am I believing is true in this moment? Or like Byron Katie with the work, you know, is this true? So there's a way of really questioning those deep beliefs. You can even play with it. Like, let's say I'm really opinionated about a particular stance. Can I take the opposite point of view? You know, if I take that opposite point of view, I have to soften my position. And noticing too, when there's times when you're not very opinionated, that you're not caught in a position. Perhaps you see a hummingbird, you see a beautiful sight of nature, and you're just naturally still with it. You don't want to intrude upon that. You're just caught, you're just speechless from wonder. In that moment, you're not so present. There's not the proliferation. So that ideally, that's what happens. That becomes more and more the guidepost. You start to orient yourself not to the pain of the moment, but to the absence of that pain, the release of the pain. The absence of the dukkha becomes the guidance. Yeah? Yeah, so you get the taste of that, and then you just keep recalling that taste. Yeah, I think that's the best way, and that's the ultimate way. Because if you just stay with the pain, that's, we just get exhausted by that. We just can get more and more contracted. But we connect with the pain in order to see the emptiness of that, to see the release of that position. Yes, Romali.
Is the neutral the scene of the bird and just watching it without infringing on it?
Yeah, that's a nice question. So in terms of Vedana or feeling tones, that there's the three of them. There's the quality of a moment's experience can be perceived as pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, often called neutral. Is that the same quality of neutrality? Is that what I'm talking about with that moment of stillness, of quiet? I would say I'm just kind of going off my own experience that it's yes and no. That sometimes, you know, I think when our minds are kind of so caught in reactivity and delusion, neutrality is more a sense of delusion, a sense of kind of not paying attention, just confused. Like, you know, you walk into the room, you don't even notice that the paint has been painted or something like that. It just, your mind kind of skips over that. You know, just like how we skip over, you know, many aspects of life because we're just not paying attention. So I think that's kind of the unpurified quality of that. And the flip side of that is there are going to be things that we're very reactive to because we find it unpleasant. That unpleasantness creates this proliferation of reactivity. There's things we find very pleasant, which creates another kind of reactivity of craving and wanting and moving toward. So that's kind of our normal, you know, human mind. But as we practice, those become much more transformed. When a pleasant thing arises, we meet that, we enjoy that, but where there's not a sense of having to move toward it to make more of it. I see that it's arising, it's beautiful, but I also see it's going to fade, holding the emptiness. I'm not arising, I'm such a great person to be able to have this hummingbird stand next to me. I'm not creating a sense of self with that. Okay, there's just this direct relationship to it. Same thing with the unpleasant. Something difficult arises, I'm able to meet that. then neutrality, that's used your words, is, I think, becomes more of a purified state, kind of a sense of equanimity. They're able to relate to a moment's experience without having to grab it, to fixate it in some ways, or to create a sense of me around it at the same time. And then there's just it's just awareness meeting life. It's, you could say, just life, stillness is meeting stillness.
But, you know, traditionally when there's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling, that wasn't, the neutral feeling wasn't that awareness. The neutral feeling was that, the unconsciousness.
That's my understanding of the traditional teachings and my experience of them. Yeah, the neutral feeling classically is much more of a sense of just not paying attention and being more delusional, right? But it's interesting with practice. I don't know if you've noticed this, that as you practice more, there's more things you find neutral. That there's not a strong Vedana of pleasant or unpleasant arising. That's more accessible. That becomes much more of a natural state. And so I think that's different than the kind of the reactivity model of Vedana. Because Vedana, remember, is part of that whole cycle of dependent origination. It becomes kind of the touch point that we go into tanha, into craving and clinging and birthing and all that. But if we're not going into that, then we're just meeting the moment's experience. There's less and less reactivity to that. Does that make sense? Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah. All right, maybe one more if there's one out there. Yes.
Well, what about, is love dukkha? Can you love something and not get stuck or caught? How does that work?
So is love dukkha, or is it possible to love something without getting caught? So, you know, as I started the talk about how words have a particular meaning for us, so we have to kind of unpack that. What do you mean by love? What does that mean? And, you know, love is such a wide, range of what we mean by that. And I think in the highest level of love, yeah, absolutely, it transcends dukkha. You know, it's like that sense of meeting life, and there's a full-hearted intimacy with it, a full-hearted connection, without strings, without an agenda, without, I love you as long as you don't do that one thing, or those 10 things, or whatever it might be. But I love you when you're in a bad mood, when you're smelly or stinky, or whatever it might be. That the quality of love transcends all those differences. It goes beyond the Vedana that's not arising. But if there's a condition to it, I love you if you like that, or I love you when I'm, well-fed and rested, then I can love you, then dukkha is there. The more conditions, the more requirements for the love to be there, the more dukkha. It's almost like we could look at it as a ratio there. Yeah, that's a nice question. All right.